A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. Hi, Spanners here, just dropping in for a quick midweek buffet. Later in the show, we've got a fabulous interview with Mark Preston, who is not only one of the best Formula E bosses on the grid, but also spearheaded the technical team that launched the dream that was Super Aguri F1. I was smiling all the way through that interview. It's an interview that you can just melt into, so I really hope you enjoy that as much as I did. And a little bit earlier today, we caught up with Mike Caulfield, who was the head strategist at Haas, and he helped us be better armchair strategists and gave us a bit of a real insight, actually, into the driver mindset when they're picking what strategies they're going to try and approach in the race. So here it is now. Here at Missed Apex Podcast, we consider ourselves trend setters, and that's why we had an F1 strategist on Missed Apex Podcast before it was cool. Joining Matt and I today is Mike Caulfield, who was a strategist at Mercedes and at Haas. How's it going, Mike?
Yeah, good to be back.
First question, who do you prefer, the Mercedes team or the Haas team? Who were the best? I wouldn't say sporting-wise, but who were just the better human beings?
I mean, the great guys at both teams, so I can't really split them up between the two there.
Okay, but let me be nosy. There must have been a massive difference in atmospheres between probably the more corporate Mercedes team and then maybe more of a privateer attitude in the Haas garage.
Yeah, I mean, they're obviously different. The massive scales to the teams which are different. So obviously, yeah, you got your Mercedes who are close to 1,000 people. Haas is, yeah, I mean, at best were 200, 250. And I guess my role was slightly different between the two because I was traveling a lot more with Haas. Well, I was traveling full time with Haas, whereas Mercedes, I was mainly factory based. So it's you're also with different groups of people. But again, at Mercedes, there was a really good atmosphere back at the kind of race support where you're having like 20 odd people. A lot of them are students, so close to kind of my age at that time, not anymore.
It was a long time ago, Mark.
I think one thing to say about Mercedes, I mean, it's maybe gradually starting to change now. Obviously, you had James go over to Williams, but a lot of the kind of trackside engineers have been trackside since basically the BAR days. So there's not been a huge turnaround in like a lot of the people there. So it's, it was quite a, I guess when you're fresh into F1, daunting to go with like these kind of people when you're kind of fresh and young and you got these experienced guys. Whereas Haas, I was fresh in. They're obviously, a smaller team, and then there's a lot of guys but you're all chipping in a little bit more because of that aspect. So there's definitely different atmospheres between the two, but Yeah, I can't kind of split them. I've still got good friends at both teams, so it's I can't really say which one's better.
Well, look, I tried my best to get some raunchy insight there, but that's an interesting thing you say about Mercedes, where essentially when people aren't moving on because they're successful, it's kind of like dead man's shoes. So you're waiting for someone to retire or get sacked, and obviously while everything's going well, there's little opportunity for movement. So I guess, you know, someone like James Vowles eventually, to go into a team principal role, they're going to have to move away. But it does seem like Mercedes, you know, they're the sort of organisation that is encouraging people and would be happy for James to do that and thrive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing. And he didn't have to do any kind of gardening leave of any extent, maybe a couple of months when he went, and they've just go off into, yeah, what is a very senior role. And I mean, maybe it might have been different if he was approached to go to the kind of Ferrari or Red Bull for some reason, but going to someone like Williams, which obviously Toto has a bit of history with, maybe that sweetened the deal a little bit. But yeah, I mean, even when I was there, and like back in the really competitive days, I know when kind of guys from Aero or stuff were going to like Alpine or Racing Point, as it was at the time, they were still kept involved pretty much right until the leave date.
Oh, really?
They might have had like only a couple of weeks, kind of a month or so. I mean, these are kind of less senior roles, so maybe like your head of aerodynamics might have been pushed aside a little bit more, but it was very encouraging at Merck. Even when I was like left to go to Haas, the same thing, I worked right up until my leave date. I had no gardening leave whatsoever, so it's They're quite trusting in that sense to certain teams, I imagine.
I might have been talking about gardening leave a bit recently. And one of the things that I was curious about, especially because I see that in the more junior roles, that there tends to be less emphasis on it. Is that because, especially at teams like Mercedes, you'd be very sort of compartmentalized with regards to the information you had, as sort of like if I was a junior aero person, looking at, oh, I don't know, like the left rear corner of the car, or the brake ducts there. There's not a huge amount of stuff that I'm going to take to like a Red Bull or Ferrari or direct competitor. Whereas maybe if I'm in a more senior role, I have a much broader view of the overall concept and design of the car.
Great question.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much nailed on in a certain sense, for especially when it comes to your designers. Yeah, I think the more senior you are, the more you potentially know about the processes and the actual designs. And I guess as well, like someone like Mercedes and why they've been so successful over the previous years, they used to have kind of a split between like three design teams. They'd have a current year, the next year, and the year after that, all working on it. So you potentially where you are in that process would also depend on like how much information you may be going. If there was someone like working, for example, now does people start to work with the 2026 regulations, it's kind of still quite new at the moment, maybe that's fine. But as you get closer, if you've built up a couple of years of knowledge and experience, then there might be kind of an extent where, right, no, you've got a lot of information and we don't want you to go somewhere. But it's also quite interesting in terms of, I guess there's that kind of that etiquette. I mean, you obviously can't forget your stuff. You can't forget things you've learned, but at the same time, you're supposed to be kind of professional about it. Like it's quite strange. Even as at Mercedes, I wasn't like the head of strategy. I was just a strategy engineer there. But I actually tended to find out a lot more which was going on at a team like Mercedes than I did when I was at Haas. And it was the one thing that really surprised me actually, but they weren't shy in kind of sharing information. And then maybe it's different in certain departments, but for myself anyway, I got to know a lot of information, which helped me as well learning my career. And again, it was that kind of sensibility. Before I left, it was kind of a case of, well, there's certain things you can take, certain things you can't. You can't unlearn it, but just be sensible about what you do. And because obviously, if it comes out, we know it's come from you. So it's kind of that.
So for a second there, I thought you were going to say, oh, it's down to honour and integrity. But really, it's because it would be quite easy for it to get busted. Oh, Caulfield's gone over to Haas, and all of a sudden, they've got our like S-duct tracking. There's only one way they could have got that. It's a good question, Matt. Well done.
Yeah, I was like, oh, look, Haas has DAS all of a sudden. Where did that come from?
But look, the real reason we've got you here is to grill you about some strategy stuff. And I saw you tweeting shortly after the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix, because on paper, from a strategy side, it kind of looked pretty simple. the safety car shook things up. But how did you see that? Because from our amateur point of view, we want to be good armchair strategists. And certainly in the last few seasons, we've got very used to undercut being king. Is that still the case?
It's going to vary circuit on circuit now, I think. I think somewhere like Saudi, with the degradation, which was quite low, it wasn't as strong as it would be. And especially, like you said, with the safety car coming out, obviously that negates the undercut anyway. But you're looking for kind of big deltas between tyres. And for a start, a lot of things kind of go into the hard tyre. That hard tyre is potentially a little bit slower at the beginning of a stint. So that already harms the undercut, because even though you're going onto a tyre which can go longer, that initial warm-up might be a little bit slower and you just don't get that kind of pace advantage going to it, even though your soft or mediums you're running the first are already degraded. But I wouldn't say it's not an option. I think in certain tracks, you'll still see the undercut, which will be quite strong. Like in Bahrain, the undercut was still strong. I think in Saudi, it was just a bit lower degradation. The tyres were just that little bit more.
So that's quite key. So what we're saying is more degradation gives you more options when it comes to the undercut. So Bahrain, known for being quite an abrasive track. Say, for example, Alonso and Aston Martin were really aggressive with the undercut and kind of threw everyone. They sort of dragged Mercedes out of their set strategy and put them on the defensive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you've answered your own question.
Sorry,
then.
I just wanted to show off. I wanted to show off that I've learned some things from you over these interviews, Mike.
No, but yeah, yes, you got the higher degradation. Yeah, you got more chance of an undercut going on there. So but also it's that kind of crossover, because if you go pull it too early, you're not obviously as high on the degradation curve. So at that point, you don't get that big benefit going to it. So it's that kind of balance between when you go to start forcing other people in or not.
So the undercut is more effective the longer you go into that stint. So it's almost like a game of chicken.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is as well is, because as you go earlier in the stint, the field's not spread out as much as well. So you're more likely to also drop into traffic. So also you're looking for that window where you can drop into free air, and that point also where you've got enough benefit of going onto a fresh set of tyres compared to a tyre which is slightly to degrade, yeah.
Well, I had a sort of follow-up question for that seemed to be particularly the case at Jeddah, which is, how much does being in, say, a DRS train affect your tyre degradation?
It's an interesting one. It depends on how much you're being actually restricted in terms of pace. So if you're in a DRS train, you can't overtake, but you feel once you're in free air, you can go a second a lot faster. You're actually protecting your tyres in that instance, because you're not actually using your car to its full potential. So you're actually limited by the car who's leading that train. Yeah. And he's probably actually using his tyres up more, because he's having to defend. He's having to kind of make sure he gets all his entries, exits, all that correctly. Whereas you're kind of just thinking, oh, I am quite got the pace to overtake him. So I'd just sit here and wait as such. So like someone like, I think a prime example of it is kind of, it's Leclerc's stint on the soft, and then everyone went, oh, the softs were really good in that first stint. But actually, his degradation was only probably lower because his pace was actually masked early on, because he was stuck in traffic with cars which were slower than him. If he'd been in free air throughout, you'd actually probably seen his actually degradation would have been normal. So you've got to kind of pace correct it for actually the traffic he's in and relative to his actual pace. And you also saw that's why he came in about lap 15, 16. I think his tyres were probably actually close to being done by that point, which is why he came in. There's actually one other reason which he didn't actually need to, which actually cost him in the end because of the safety car coming out two laps later. But that's just something they may have missed at the time and weren't catching up on.
Well, I think, did he not come in like right after Max finally passed him on the medium? So maybe that was just an attempt to stay close.
Well, Max was just about to pass him. So he would have passed him down that straight and dived into the pits. What he'd actually done, I think looking at it, I think that might have been a slight reason, because obviously he'd lost a bit of time. But actually, Stroll was just being pushed out of his window. So Stroll had already made his stop and he was actually falling out his pit window. And on that lap, Stroll was actually just edging out the window. So it was a chance for Ferrari and Leclerc to actually overcut him in that sense. What they actually failed to realize by looking kind of at GPS or something, but Stroll's issue had already started. So the reason he was dropping out wasn't to do with tires or anything. It's because his issue had already started. So if you'd looked at his straight line speed, he's just going slower and slower every lap. So they didn't actually need to kind of do that. So even if they'd got overtaken by Verstappen and then made the stop the next lap, they would have still probably pushed out Stroll, and obviously Stroll would have stopped. And obviously if they could have pushed that a little bit longer, they would have taken benefit of the safety car as well.
Yeah, I love the fact that we are brand new talking about Ferrari strategy errors in races here. I want to talk about Hamilton on the hard tire, but before I do, I went back and looked through all the various pit stops because Pirelli puts out the very nice infographic. And I wanted to, like originally I was like, Stroll, we want to talk about that. I'm curious about that. And then I realized that pretty much the entire midfield, with the sole exception of, I think, of Sargeant, actually pitted before the safety car and like really a bit earlier than I would have anticipated based on the strategy guidance Pirelli gave. Do you know, can you explain to me why that came about?
So looking at it, I mean, I obviously, and it's always the caveat I always put on it, is like, I don't know the full ins and outs of teams. I don't know if it's like pre-planned in certain aspects or kind of there's an issue maybe with the cars. Some cars may be like slightly worse on tires than others, but from what I look at it, it actually all starts from Piastri's stop on lap one. So actually Piastri starts coming back into the window and Norris, so obviously they've had their 2-1s for nose changes on lap one and lap two. And then as they start coming in close to the window, you get Magnussen stopping and Bottas stopping. And then obviously that then causes a chain reaction for the other midfield cars to then stop there and cover it off, basically, in that respect. So it's all kicked off of trying to cover. Because I think the belief was, even though Pirelli sent out that infographic, that the hard could last the whole race. So I think it was that interesting one that, if you may be struggling at that point on your mediums, you don't want to cost too much time and you're going to try and cover off, put yourself in free air, the hard's going to lift anyway. Whereas if you maybe leave it a couple laps later, all right, you're more than likely going to be able to overtake the McLaren, but you're going to lose that, cost that little bit of time doing that overtake. And then someone around you may either prevent the undercut or even get the overcut. So you just take that kind of safety option of covering off and putting yourself in free air, really.
Okay, well, I mean, I think we saw Piastri did the whole race minus one lap on the hard tire, so they wouldn't have been wrong about that. And so just to follow up with my Hamilton question real quick, if you don't mind, it seems like he got a little bit toasted by the timing of that safety car, because it looked like to me he was actually starting to get faster on those tires. Like there was a long stretch of time where they were going to be quite quick once they finally came in.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I'll admit I was surprised that Hamilton started on the hard. And again, I don't know the ins and outs. I'm not going to criticize them. They'll obviously have the reasons. I was actually expecting Verstappen to start on the hard because being out of position with a very fast car, it's a strategy which will work regardless of kind of what happens. But Hamilton started on the hards last year and started on the hards this year. And the exact same thing's basically happened in 2 years. But a safety car comes out around this point, which destroys any race if you start on that hard tire. Like if you get a safety car around the lap 30 region, 28 to like 34, you're laughing because you're in that window, you gain an extra time and you're on fresh tires compared to everyone else towards the end. But now he has to take that because obviously the field packs back up and now he's on a set of tires, which, okay, they can last to the end, but it's not premium to run the mediums for 30 laps.
So basically when that safety car came out, it negated all the work of, okay, let's get these hards further into the race and then come out with fresh, stickier tires on a lower fuel load and start making stuff up. So Mercedes gambled that there wasn't going to be a safety car at a track where there's definitely going to be a safety car.
I wouldn't say not a safety car. I think they were just hoping there was going to be a safety car a bit later. But it's an interesting view they take because it's a strategy you do kind of if you feel your car's out of position. So like I said, with a Verstappen, you've got a fast car, but a qualifying issue has meant you're midway down the pack. So it just allows you to do something different because ultimately, if you're out of position and you do the same as everything else, you're only going to kind of gain what you can gain on track, whereas this one gives you that opportunity to make bigger gains. So when like Hamilton, I can't remember exactly where he qualified, 7th, I think it was. It's like, I mean, unfortunately, that's not really where he's out of place for the Mercedes. That's around the pace of the car, around that kind of 4th to 7th position. So you could have probably gained as many places on a standard medium hard strategy and just going for the undercut, going for a good start performance, which you'd get off a medium tire over a hard anyway. And then you potentially gain a couple places, or like say a car falls out in front and you've got a chance of a podium, where like basically like what happened to Russell basically, but he's on the edge of a podium. And there's that opportunity. So I'm other than like hoping for a late safety car, it's for me, it just seemed a strange choice considering they did exactly this last year and it didn't happen work for them last year either.
Okay, let's talk about Russell real quick. I, looking at it, felt like at the time he began to filibuster to not let Hamilton go by because Lewis was on different tire strategy.
There
was enough tire left for Lewis to actually bother the Ferrari ahead, maybe fight a little bit and slow them down. And had he done that, that would have brought the both of them back to Russell, who obviously had good tires at the end of the race. Do you think that was a bit of a missed opportunity? Like if you were in charge, would you have let Lewis by at that point? That's really what I want to know. Somebody else's problem to deal with the drivers after the race.
Don't worry about the personalities or egos.
Yeah, okay. On the numbers, for me, if you got two cars together, one's clearly quicker at the point, given that opportunity. It would have, like you said, if the worst case happens, he goes ahead, he doesn't cause any issues with the anyone in front, and then you just invert them later on again. So, and best case, he actually gains position and the team owns that. So, like, in terms of the team point of view, I didn't really see what the benefit of not giving him a chance anyway was, other than politics,
So what we said, I think, after the race was that Russell basically ruined his own strategy in a way, because his strategy would have been to conserve tyres at that phase, but it was more important for him to stay ahead of Lewis Hamilton, use up a little bit of the tyres and go, no, I'm faster. But obviously that affects your strategy later. But what that tells me from a political point of view, in an unearned guess, is that I think Russell is set out in that team as the number two driver. But he knows if he can score little wins, there is just a chance that he gets far enough ahead that he is then, considered the number one driver at some point. And maybe that convinces Lewis Hamilton that enough's enough. And there's a big political game going on there. It was a little cheeky from Russell. I've got the feeling that the dynamic in that team is, on paper, of course, you can race. But I think that is still Hamilton's team, and Russell is very much being looked at for the future. It was such a great insight into everyone's minds.
I think from my experience with Mercedes, I was like, I kind of expected this was going to be the case last year, and then obviously things happened, and my kind of thought, based on no knowledge whatsoever, like just guessing.
We don't mind. It's Mr. Apex. If you get on the big boys ones, they're going to want a little bit more, caveat. you're in the shed, Mike. Don't worry about it.
This is the big one. I thought last year would be a case of, if they had a competitive car, let Lewis win his eighth championship, support him, and then the team shows afterwards. So in terms of this year, I kind of feel they're more on an even footing this year. And it's I don't know, as well, with the kind of change in kind of structure and everything which has happened with the team, I don't know whether they are now kind of starting to look at the future and almost kind of, ruled out this season. I mean, well, we can rule out this season. Red Bull's going to win all 23, but that's...
I think it's up for grabs for Russell more this season. So Russell could stamp himself as the number one this season. It wasn't really on last season. Whatever was happening with the experiments and points. Max.
Exactly.
Go on, Mike. Sorry.
I agree with you as well. I kind of feel that, they're free to race, and I don't think that either of them is going to get any special treatment this year.
Matthew?
Well, there is one other team on the grid with a similar-ish situation, and that would be Red Bull, where Perez scored a win. But the question I have for you, because you've watched two races and you've seen them, it just, from the outside, looks like Red Bull has a much more neutral car that Perez is able to drive a lot closer to Max. I mean, I was really impressed with his second stint when the two of them were both in free air. Max wasn't really making any headway. does he have maybe a little bit more of a chance at extra race wins? Or do you really think he's, like, as everyone is quote unquote saying, that he's much more circuit specific?
I'd agree with you. I kind of feel that the car does look a little bit better suited to Perez this year. I mean, and like you said, that second stint was, yeah, he knew what Max was doing and he just matched him. So it was a very deserved win. And yeah, like literally Max couldn't do anything about it. Whether is it circuit specific? Potentially. I think Perez does have a style which kind of makes him suit certain circuits better than others, whereas Max is obviously that bit more all round. Anywhere he goes, he's pretty out fast and all right, a good driver. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens this weekend as well. I mean, just obviously make sure that there's no reliability issues for Perez either.
Oh, reliability issues. That's interesting, because there was a quote-unquote drive shaft problem in the race. But Eddie Jordan, who, as I've always said, speaks truth and nothing but the truth, said on the Formula 4 Success podcast, I think Max concocted something about a drive shaft to make himself look good. I'm absolutely convinced that he was told before he went out that if Checo is leading, you do not have permission to pass him. There's some really interesting politics going on there. I don't see that, but what Mr. Jordan's is painting a picture of is basically Max going, nuh-uh, I definitely could have overtaken Perez, but the drive shaft thing. And the whole time the team was going, well, we can't see anything. I mean, it's fine. Eddie Jordan has a reputation for this kind of thing, but it's a fun little snippet.
Yeah, no, I think it'll be interesting this season between the two of them. Unfortunately, that's where I think the majority of races we're going to have to look for entertainment. So let's hope Perez is generally closer to it.
I'm a little bit curious because Ferrari, who we've talked about their mistakes already, came out after the race. I think it was Carlos Sainz, and said that the issue they're having with the car, and especially with managing the tires, is one that they feel they have correlation with in the wind tunnel. So question one is, have you ever been on a team where that sort of a thing has happened? And what are the odds that they could at least make this a bit closer with development in this season, if that statement is true?
So yes, definitely been involved in a team which has had the issues with the tires, and you can see it very, it's generally a case. I mean, I don't know, it could be a number of things, but I think it's kind of issue where you'll have a sudden loss of downforce in certain specific areas of the kind of cornering phase. Unfortunately, that just causes the tires to slide a bit more, and then you're going to struggle to kind of get around it in that respect. So it's uses tires up more, plus you lose a bit of time. So potentially on a kind of like a one lap run, because you're pushing the car to the limit so much, you don't get that issue. But when you're trying to manage it and throughout the run as the tires go, you're just going to slide them, and it just takes that little bit out more. So yeah, whether they can develop it to get out of it, I mean, it's that. From past experience with team I was with, when they don't, it was a difficult one. You never quite gain it back. So it's going to be not an easy fix, unless they know exactly what it is. But I mean, if they can see it in the wind tunnel, that's one thing. But actually trying to figure it out, because they're all interlaced parts in terms of this causes this to happen, this causes to happen. So you can't just change one tiny little bit and fix it. So it's, well, maybe you can, but it's very rare in an aerodynamic point of view, but that you can just change one little bit and you're suddenly going to gain all your kind of tire performance back.
Okay, so fast forward to Interlagos. Where are they on the fastest teams scale by that point? Let's have a guess. Let's have a wag.
I'd say they'll be, I mean, they're still going to be up there. They're going to be, well, definitely not first. they're going to be second or third fastest. Yeah, they'll be remain. I mean, the second, third, fourth teams, I think, are going to be very, very much interchangeable throughout the season, depending on what circuit it is.
Yeah.
I don't think really anyone else is going to get up to the point of mixing it with them at that point.
So I just put a little pin in what you were talking about earlier with the strategy. And the thing that stuck out there is it's not all team strategists sat there in an island by themselves. There's this cascade effect when teams start pitting, A, you get to have a look at how a different tyre is responding. So, you know, Hamilton was like the sacrificial lamb. Everyone got to look at his hard tyre data and see how the hards were doing. But Red Bull were really great for this during the kind of 2017, 2018 period when they were sitting a third but developing well. They would be really aggressive with that undercut, and they sometimes dictated the whole strategy of races. And I think there was a lot of races during that period that would have been one stops if it wasn't for Red Bull scaring everyone with these, with the undercuts. And so it's a much more kind of dynamic picture than I think we get from our sofas, where we just think, oh, well, we would just do the softs and then the hards, or we would do soft, hard to get through this. Really, it's a very fluid situation.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the Red Bull situation a couple of years back was they were in like that kind of beautiful place in a strategist land where you didn't really have any threats from behind, so you could try and like, and if you didn't do anything really different, you'd end up where you started. So they had like had that nice place where, right, well, we need to do something a little bit aggressive or a little bit different. And worst thing that happens is, okay, we drop back and we finish 30 seconds behind the leading few, but we're still 30 seconds ahead of everyone else. So there might not be teams who have that kind of benefit this year because the field is that little bit closer together. But yeah, it is very much dynamic, and it's dynamic in a sense that you'll try and plan out a race before you go into it. So like on a Saturday night, Sunday morning, you'll look at a planner. You obviously don't know exactly what's going to happen at the start. You don't know what kind of positions are going to change, who's going to crash out, etc. But you'll have different plans for kind of if you maintain your position, if you gain positions, etc. And then you try and look at kind of your first bit is, well, I want to kind of look at where there's going to be a window opening up, where do we expect our paces to be? So it's going to be a window, and who's going to make that first stop, and depends on what start tide are on, etc. So going into like last weekend, you'll have looked at it, and like they say, those midfield teams, because the pace is quite tight, you generally know if you're a midfield team, if there's been no unexpected pit stops first, the first person to make the stop is going to drop back to basically last on the grid. And you kind of just want to make sure that you kind of, you're in the right window with your tyres, but you can go into a bit of free air and you can exploit it, and you're not going to kind of in two laps catch up with the slowest cars and then mess around fighting with them and et cetera. And then it'll cause that trigger off there. And it's all about kind of just balancing out that kind of tyre life with where you can get that free air to exploit it.
It's almost like they should be speaking to the strategists on the pit wall and not the CEO at some point, because, you know, I'm not sure how much, you know, Christian Horner or Seidel or Zach Brown are really involved in that. And that's probably the most interesting chess match that we as viewers don't really get to see.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's one thing which I kind of, I've been pushing for a while in terms of like the graphics on TV as well, just aren't good enough in showing what you're going on, because you're watching it and you kind of like looking, you see the kind of timing score down the side, you know, like, okay, but who's pitted? Who hasn't pitted? What's the gap between these? Where's this pit window? Like, kind of, what happens if this person pits, and where they're going to fall out? And that's kind of information you want to see it first, and then you can start explaining the story of what's actually going to happen in the race, because you'd be like, you can be shouting at the screen, why aren't they pitted? Why aren't they pitted yet? Pirelli said it was going to be 12 laps, but the reason why is because they're going to drop behind five cars who are all fighting each other, and you're just going to lose a lot of time.
I think we need to get Mike on a Zoom call during races, Matt, and then we can sound clever from listening to. Basically, we can just watch Mike's face, and when it drops or he starts yelling at the screen, we know that someone's done something wrong. Okay, so you're slightly just sidestepped out of the active strategist role, Mike. There, I've just stated, and I'm not a Red Bull fan, but I am an admirer of just how aggressive how proactive their strategy tends to be. Feel free to answer this however you want. Which team have the best strategy approach, or which teams impress you on the grid from a strategy point of view? Long pause from Mike Caulfield. Look, it would be difficult if I said, Mike, who's terrible? Who sucks at strategy? I'm not doing that.
I mean, I do think I agree with you. I think Red Bull's strategy over the last few years has been one of the best. It's definitely, they've kind of adjusted for all the situations. They've done the kind of leading, they've done the challenging for the lead, and then they've, like you said, that bit where they weren't quite the fastest car, but they were still putting themselves in positions
dictating
to do it.
Races.
So I think they've definitely got one of the best structures in place. I think Mercedes have done well over the years as well. It's always different kind of going from, especially when you've been so dominant for a number of years, to then being a team which is then having to kind of make some considerations of out from what they didn't have to before. So it's that kind of changing in that mindset of where you were trying to make sure you didn't do anything stupid because as a strategist as well, if you're racing for the win, the worst that can happen is chucking away the win. Whereas if you're in the midfield, you can try something that a little bit more aggressive and go, okay, we could have got seventh, we got eighth instead. And they're like, no one really knows. You know yourself. Yeah. And like, personally, if it's me, I'm gutted if that happens, but you don't get the kind of media backlash when it does happen.
Well, but if you get a podium from that, then you look like a genius.
Yeah. I mean, and this is kind of why strategy is such a, it's not just a kind of numbers based science. I'm not going to say it's an art form because that's a bit.
Do it.
It's
more of an art.
There's a lot of personalities behind it as well. So, I mean, you've got 10 strategists or 10 head of strategies on the grid. And if you like put cars all the same pace and you gave like everyone had the day and like you then ran practice, you ran quali, you've obviously got a grid run it. You'd probably get 60% of the strategists choosing one thing, 30% choosing another thing, 10% and 10% doing another thing. You'll still get a lot of different strategies, even though everyone had the same numbers and the same car pace, just because you'll have some people who are that little bit more aggressive. Some people might go for that, prefer to take that option where, all right, this strategy will work one time in 100, but when it does work, we're going to look like kings. The rest of the time, we just look like a bit.
The Jensen button in the rain approach. Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, because I remember I had I had a conversation when we were in Haas in 2019. Yeah, 19 or 20, when the car wasn't very good anyway, one of the two. And like, I was having a chat with, it must have been 19. I was chatting with Kev and he was kind of going, I don't care if I finish 11th. I'd rather try something and finish in the points than finish 11th. And like, I was showing him these things. I was like, okay, this strategy here, like, hey, I've got this one strategy here, which requires every little DP thing. It's like, this happens here, this happens here, this happens. He's going, let's try. And I said to him, yeah, this is one strategy out of 100,000 I've run here.
I love it.
It's like, so these are the odds of this actually happening. But he still wanted to try it anyway.
I love
and
it.
Then and came back after.
Did it work?
And it didn't. No idea, because it didn't.
So you're like, okay, if these 12 miracles happen, we're P6 and we look like heroes.
Exactly, yeah. And that's it. But like, yeah, you kind of balance it up. And sometimes, I mean, there's more calculated approaches where like I'm being really exaggerated on some of the effects, but a lot of the times you do require like a safety car coming out in a really opportune moment and everything. But if you don't try this, all you're going to do is end up 14th having started 15th. So it's worth trying something for some people.
Well, I think sort of a classic example of that might have been last year at Albert Park with Albon changing tire, going to the last lap, changing tires and winding up with points. So, like, what was your biggest jackpot, the longest odds strategy you ever ran that made you look like a king for a day?
So my one was the ballsy move in Hungary where we pitted up after the formation lap to get off the wet tires. We got penalty for it, undeserved in my opinion. But we still got points with one car. I would have got double points if it weren't for the penalties. Yeah, but everyone else went onto the grid on wet tyres. We struck dries on, and then after four laps, we were running, I think it was third and fourth. And obviously then the pace, I mean, and this was in 2020, but so the car was the worst car on the field. So it's not like, but it was the only chance of us getting points, and it was worth a risk. Yeah, let's take it.
All right, let's talk percentages. It's very common in Formula One that, you know, they say it's this much car, it's this much driver. And I think a lot of people settle around it's 85% car, but the driver can make a 15% difference, you know, from the best driver to the worst driver. Let's carve out a strategist piece of that pie. How much difference can a good strategist make to, I don't know, if Matt was doing it?
I mean, obviously, I don't want to put myself out of a job, so it's a good chunk in that. But no, I mean,
easily 80%.
So, I mean, it's the most important factor.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
But no, I mean, it's like I said, there's potential for like getting points here and there, like in picking up, and it's, you've all got to put it relative. But I'll say, go back to that hash year we had when the car was in awful in 2020, or 2021, even worse. And it was pretty hard because no matter what you did, you knew you were kind of fighting a losing battle because your car was just so far off. So in that sense, your strategist, you really haven't got much chance whatsoever. However, if you're in that kind of position where you're going for race wins or even a kind of strong midfield team, then the strategist does have, I think, quite a significant impact in what can be potentially go right. Yeah. I mean, and I always kind of refer to it as well as like one driver, I won't name him, but he kind of, I never seem to get any credit when I did good strategies, but I always got the blame, obviously, when the strategies went wrong. So I kind of always refer it to like an airline pilot, but they're expected to land the plane. And so you're expected to get the good strategy. If you get it wrong, you're going to get in trouble.
Actually, it was a terrible question to ask, saying what percentage is down to the strategist when your last car was towards the back end of the grid, because you were hardly going to go, that was a great car with brilliant drivers. But because I just kept rolling the dice wrong, that's why it was at the back of the grid. Mike Caulfield, thank you so much for your time. It's been fascinating to get this insight, and people should follow you at Mike Caulfield F1. The links will be in the show notes below, but thank you very much for joining us in the shed.
No, thank you very much. No, it's been good. Cheers.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hi. Today I'm going to take you back to a Formula One from a long, long time ago in a regulation set far, far away from our own. Back in a time when Formula One had just been liberated from the Scuderia Death Star and the all-powerful Darth Schumacher by a young new hope called Fernando Alonso. But it's not about Fernando or El Plan. Our tale takes place before retired champion Sebastian Vettel even turned a wheel in Formula One. Lewis Hamilton was dicing in the Junior Series, and Red Bull were powered by a Ferrari engine. Our tale is a tale of 100 days, 100 days to get an F1 team onto the grid and beyond. Today we tell the tale of Super Aguri, and I am welcoming the man that was the technical big dog at Super Aguri and one of the most successful Formula E bosses around. It's Mark Preston. Thanks so much for joining us, Mark.
Thank you. It's going to be fun to talk about the history of Super Aguri.
Well, I hope you don't mind us having story time with Uncle Mark. And the thing is, it doesn't feel like it's a long time ago when you just say, oh, 2006, 2007. But in Formula One terms, it's an eon ago.
It is, isn't it? I can hardly remember how far back it was. It's good to talk about it.
Yeah, and so you are familiar with some of the people on our panel. So Uncle Joe Saywood has stormed the paddock, and you've had to face him down in media. Is he as formidable as he seems in the shed?
Yes. When I first became technical director in Formula One, I was warned by my PR person that you're about to meet the formidable Joe Saywood, and be ready, be scared. And and I was, but it was a great conversation the first time I was interviewed by him.
And it's a really interesting path that Super Aguri took into Formula One, because the first car was basically the SA05, so after the year that it was developed, and it was essentially an upgraded 2002 Arrows car, and that seems insane in modern F1 terms. You could never try and enter F1 now with a three-year-old car and just try and make it good.
Yeah, it was a funny story, because obviously I'd worked at Arrows, and I'd been heavily involved in that A23 from Arrows, and so I knew, you know, I knew it backwards, I knew it forwards. I'd been really involved in it, and I'd known that Paul Stoddart had bought all of the assets of Arrows and had them down in Ledbury. So I'd actually gone to see him the year before and said, "So have you got everything?" He's like, yeah, come and have a look at everything. And I said, I was looking around, opening drawers and things like that, and going, "Oh yeah, I know where that is. I know what that is. Okay, cool." And so when the whole thing kicked off, we rang him up and said, "Can we buy it all back, please?" So it was quite a funny story. I had actually, the reason I knew it was possible was after I was at Arrows.
Yeah. Sorry. No, this is what I was going to ask, because I couldn't find like any big headline, but I just found one headline from like 2005 that said Mark Preston delays plans to join Super Aguri. Were those plans for Preston F1? Oh my goodness. So you actually had, and that's an amazing thing. Like when you see the likes of like Jackie Stewart, you know, struggling to make that work, and you thought, yep, I fancy a Mark Preston F1 team.
I thought that was possible, because I went off to McLaren after being at Arrows, and we did the famous, what I call now the technology demonstrator, the MP4-18A that never raced. And what happened in that situation was we actually had to take the previous year's car and put all the newest ideas on it and basically race it in the following year. So I knew it was possible to take a one-year-old car, put all the technology on it, and we're at McLaren. So, hey, we could do it at Super Aguri.
See, this is very much more reminiscent of like films like Rush, you know, where it's a few guys with a garage and you're just in your blank green or grey overalls or covered in oil going, I think we can get this on the grid. We can make it work. And that's why I said, you know, 2005 doesn't seem like a long time ago, but in F1 terms, it really is. Like, it's ancient history. You could never go in with that attitude now, could you?
Probably not. I think the cars are so much more complicated. You know, the engines are so much more complicated than they were back then. But it was a fun time, because many of the suppliers that we normally used in F1, I remember when we were doing the fire up one night, 4 a.m. in the morning, there was a problem with one of the radiators. And the guy who owned the radiator company, he came to us and he said, "Give it to me. I'll fix the radiator." So the guy who made radiators for the last, I don't know, 30 years was with us at 4 a.m. in the morning and said, no, give it to me. I'll fix it and put it back in the car. There was such a sort of a groundswell of support around us. All the supply chain in the UK just wanted us to make it happen. Extract, everybody. It was amazing.
So what's the crossover point from I'm going to be like the next Jackie Stewart entering the fray, or the next Frank Williams, you know, Preston F1 into Super Aguri? Is that a sad story, or is that an opportunity taken?
It's an opportunity taken. We're just about to give up on the craziest, you know, idea since sliced bread.
Yeah.
And then along came Aguri with obviously Takuma, Honda, Bridgestone, all the pieces of the puzzle from that sort of thing. But he was like, okay, now we have to do a team. And we said, well, we're ready to do a team. We know who we're going to hire. We know how we're going to do it. And so it was one of those weird moments when the two things just collide. It was incredible.
Okay, well, how much of an exaggeration is it to say that Super Aguri had the soul of Preston F1 that never was?
A fair amount, actually, because most of the guys that ended up running the team had been with me for the previous year, looking at what we could do. A number of ex-Arrows people, ex-Jordan, other teams, and so we're all kind of ready to go and about to give up, and then all of a sudden this all happened in a matter of weeks.
Yeah, and it's unusually quick, that timeline from saying, right, this is going to be an entity in F1 to getting to the grid. But there's a relationship with Honda in there, so it's not quite a privateer team. It's something that we argue about on Missed Apex all the time, is I always want there to be an opportunity for people to come in almost like a customer team, with the backing of not just an engine supplier, but full support. But, you know, you've come in with essentially an upgraded three-year-old Arrows car, and then moving on to using or trying to use a Honda chassis. What was that relationship like with Honda?
Honda was incredible. It's still legendary inside of Honda. So I still, you know, meet young Honda guys and they go, you're the So there's still a lot of love for what we did inside of Honda. It was pretty crazy for even them, actually, internally. And it was interesting. They gave us some of the most experienced Honda guys that you've ever met, and I'm still friends with a lot of them. So they gave us an incredible amount of support, and it would not have been possible if they hadn't put their full force behind what we were doing. But they were also a bit surprised because they didn't also know if we could do it. So, yeah, that was pretty amazing.
Well, I don't think they were alone in wondering whether you could do it. But actually, it's nice to hear something so positive about Honda, because perhaps their reputation has taken a little bit of a kicking with the GP2 engine. And then just as they were getting good, kind of Red Bull seemed to have parked their relationship. And then, of course, they sort of famously let go of their team, handed it over to Braun and lost out on winning a world championship. So we've not heard a lot of positivity, and we've heard a lot about the cultural differences. So it's nice to hear, like you just saying, no, they're a, you know, great organization and a great team.
Yeah, we had some amazing characters in our team. Many of them that had been on the original McLarens, etc., back in the early days of the 80s, winning championships. Oh. So we had some pretty incredible characters that really, really wanted us to succeed and get to the grid. And then obviously we caused the main team a little bit of hassle in their second year for the keeping up with them, or leading them at least into the first half of the season.
So let's, for people who have perhaps, you know, new to Formula One, not heard of Super Aguri. So we're talking about the seasons here between 2006, 2007, 2008. That was the three contested seasons. But I'd like to hone in on what we talked about earlier, which was the modified Arrows car. And so what's the thinking behind that? Because that couldn't have been like a long-term solution. Was that just we need to get our car and our name and our drivers on the grid?
There was a lot of confusion at the time because they were saying we'd have B teams in Formula One. So even I think ProDrive might have been rumoured to have been a B team. Obviously,
sorry, say that name again. That was rumoured to be a B team.
It was going to be ProDrive.
Right.
At the time, there was a discussion whether they were going to enter as well. Obviously, Red Bull bought Minardi. And became their B team, which is obviously now Toro Rosso. So there was a bit of confusion at the time as to how the rules were going to work out. And so because there was a bit of confusion, the only way we could get to the grid was going to the Arrows plan.
Right.
So that's why it went that way. And everyone was like, thought we were crazy. But I remember Aguri said, so how slow will we be? And we said, I think we're going to be 5.5 seconds off the pace. And he said, okay, is that okay? And weirdly, that was the year that they got rid of the 7% rule.
Right.
So we were confident that we wouldn't get kicked out, and we were confident that we would qualify, but we were quite confident we would be 5.5 seconds off the pace.
And we should say that is as massive as it sounds. That was a big deficit.
Yeah, and by the thing that I think we were all most proud of, and even Honda, was that by the end of the year we're only a second off the grid, off the Ferraris. But that was with a lot of help from Bridgestone, because that was when the tyre war was. And so we were obviously partnered with Bridgestone, so that meant that we had some good tyres, let's say, for that battle. And so we were most proud from going 5.5 seconds off to 1.5 seconds off, or 1 second off in Brazil. And that was an incredible ride, let's say.
So that must have, in a way, been a magical time, even though you had one driver 5 seconds off. So you that was the best of it. You had one driver 9 seconds off at one point. But from a pure kind of engineering point of view, you know, I think you and I are coverall donning spanner monkeys at heart. That must have been just like almost like a, you know, a duct tape and sellotape type project to get onto the grid. And in a way, like, surely that's like the most joyful mechanic experience, even for a head technical guy.
Everybody in the team absolutely loved it, still loves it, still talks about that time and says, I wish we could go back to that year. I mean, it was mental. I think we got off Christmas Day for when we were planning the team. But I don't think we had a weekend off, a Sunday off, anything until we got to the grid. But time flew by and nobody cared. It was an amazing experience. And by the end of that year, a number of the teams had seen what we were doing. So there's a picture you can search on the internet of at the end of the year, there's a mixture of Renault mechanics and Super Aguri mechanics. What happened was they brought the champagne down to the other end of the pit lane to congratulate all the mechanics for working so hard. They'd seen us all working hard during the year. And we had some fun times when we realized we couldn't be quick. So we had to figure out ways that we could win. So we had to have little wins. So there's a classic one where, you know, in the starting grid where obviously they take the tire warmers off and then the cars, you know, head off down, head around the formation lap. What we realized was one day I was watching the grid and I saw that Ferrari would always be the last people to take the tire warmers off. And I was like, you know what? We could beat them at that. And so the next race, it doesn't matter if we get disqualified or we get a penalty because we're at the back of the grid.
Yeah.
So we realized this is a very visual thing on the TV. So we worked with the mechanics and we went later than Ferrari. So when you see the shot looking at the grid, you'll see everyone, the mechanics, take the tire warmers off in those days. But Ferrari and Renault would still have the tire warmers on and Super Aguri at the back.
Nice.
And so it was very visual on the TV. And so we were, we waited and waited and waited and they pulled the tire warmers off and then we waited and the TV with people were going, what are they doing at the back of the grid?
That's...
And then all of a sudden we took ours off.
That's
so
glorious.
It was one of those, crazy, crazy stories.
I do wonder, like, you know, if teams at the back of the grid do things to get on the telly. And now I know, now I've confirmed it's true.
Sorry, say that again. I just got cut off by Siri.
So I did always wonder as an F1 fan whether, you know, teams down the back end of the grid ever did things to get on TV. And it's a delight to know that's true.
We also took a lot of the other variables like pit stops. Back in those days, you could actually compete. I don't know if we could have competed nowadays on the 1-point-something-second pit stops. But we also tried to win the fastest pit stop. There was things like when the drivers come into the pits, they try to sort of attack the line, as they call
right.
it. So, you know, the line when you enter the pits and you have to get down to the pit lane speed. The speed at which you can get to that line and brake and get to the speed in pit lane, we used to try and beat that time. And then so what happened was the big teams realized what we were doing, because I'm sure we showed up on their screens. Why is this Super Aguri guys winning these little things? And then they came, the mechanics came and asked us, what are you guys doing? And we're like, we can't win, but we could beat you at some things.
That's
so we
amazing.
Try to beat you at the little things.
So if you look at the Super Aguri 2006 Top Trumps card, you might have pace down at 4, resources down at 5, but pit lane entry 10. tire blanket chicken 9, you know, so
yeah,
that's pretty
yeah,
good
exactly, yeah.
I no, I love that
to most people.
And I love the fact that there was respect from Renault who you know we have to remember were champions at that time. So Fernando Alonso won the 2006 and 2005 world championships with Renault back to back before moving to McLaren, but the visual of those guys coming down to the back of the grid with champagne is wonderful.
It was just the coolest thing ever. It's one of the best photos that we've still got from the time of that experience.
And actually, that was going to be my next question, which was, how were you treated by the other teams in the paddock? Because the stories I read, obviously, were that there needed to be agreement from all the teams at that time. And I believe Midland were a team that put up resistance. And then Williams, if we sort of skip ahead a little bit to the first non-Arrows chassis, also were objecting to that. So apart from the Renault love-in, how was the reaction from the other teams?
Yeah, I mean, Midland wasn't very happy that we were coming in. The top 10 Concord agreement and everything, there is a sliding scale of earnings and those kind of things. So it does have an impact, which is obviously one of the discussion points they're having at the moment, isn't it, with the new teams entering. So yeah, it was a bit of a stress. We didn't know that we were going to actually get there until the FIA eventually allowed us with a late entry to come to the grid. But because Honda was involved, of course, there was a lot of help, let's say, to get their second team in into the series.
But okay, so there's two questions there. A, was it too much help? Because you were literally using a year-old chassis and admitting to it. It wasn't like a sneaky crime. It wasn't like, you know, the Aston Martin brake duct gate or the, what did they call it, the pink Mercedes a couple of years back. No, we're using the chassis from the previous year.
And then that was the intent at the time was that B teams, they were looking at how B teams could actually operate. And, you know, the idea was generally we could take a one-year-old car. And most people thought that was going to be impossible. And obviously we took a three-year-old car and showed that it was possible.
Just about.
So we weren't going to be super quick, but we certainly had a lot of fun, trying. That was how it was meant to be. And that's why we were able to do it at least for a year or two. And then we would have had to figure it out like Toro Rosso did to continue on as their own team.
So now a little bit out of Formula One specifically, and you look at the state of Formula One, there was a time when they were moving more towards customer teams or like you could go and just purchase a chassis, or they were going to make it a little bit more of a spec series. All those kind of arguments have kind of seemed to have been shelved, and it does look like Formula One wants to be more of a works team, like a manufacturer series. But at that time, like if you're looking back now, would you have wished that would have continued? Because I like the idea of a Mark Preston being able to come in, buy a two-year-old chassis and go racing and have a 30-car grid.
Yeah, I mean, that's that sort of, for me, it goes back to the really, really old days, isn't it? The Brabhams and everybody who actually, you know, built their own car, got an engine from this guy, got a bits and pieces from somebody else and went racing. It's certainly the kind of old romantic side of motor racing. And so I think that bit is quite cool. Whether or not you could continue to compete nowadays, I'm not quite sure. It was certainly a fun time, and I'm glad we got to do it.
Yeah, but I sort of feel like Formula One as an organisation has actively moved away from that, and they'd rather have Audi come in with or you know, people with pedigree coming in and have Alfa Romeo rebadged on Sauber than have Sauber.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting, isn't it, to see what should be done nowadays. It was still a cool time, and as I say, I'm glad we got to do it. The idea, you know, you say that maybe it's not the same now, but you know, am I correct in saying that that Aston Martin uses Mercedes gearbox, right?
Sure.
And that's one of the elements of it is where do you spend your resources? And what we did was we had a car from Honda, obviously. So what did we do? We focused on the areas where we knew we could differentiate from them, which was tires at the time. So for me, it's engine, aero, tires, the three biggest, most important things. And so we had a Honda engine, we had Bridgestone tires, and it turned out that we were really good at tires. And so therefore, we were able to keep up by putting a lot of effort into tires. And so, you know, when you think about how much resource goes into a gearbox, it's ridiculous because it's a complicated thing, a really super complicated thing. So in some ways, there is still a lot of sharing of R&D because you can, you know, use an engine and a gearbox. That takes a lot of effort away from what you need to do.
Now, wonderfully and unbelievably, I know that you're actually a Missed Apex podcast listener, so you will know that me and my co-host argue about tyres and I try to steer the conversation away. But just to save a phone call from Matt when he listens back to this, why was Super Aguri strong on tyres?
Because we had a great relationship with Bridgestone.
Now then. No, because I assign 9 of Michael Schumacher's 7 titles to the fact that they had Bridgestone tyres.
Tyres are the most important thing. And probably my best experience of this was way back when I was doing Formula Fords in Australia.
Oh, wow.
No aero. Tyre testing, but all about tyres.
Yeah.
And we were able to help choose the tyres, and so we chose the tyres that were best for us. And you can see that what from that experience since then to now, I've focused incredibly on the tyres, and they make an incredible difference. And so Aguri had been a Bridgestone tyred driver since his karting days, and so we had a great relationship with Bridgestone.
I see. Yeah.
And obviously there was the tyre war going on, so we had a lot of support from Bridgestone. They were one of our sponsors as well. And that's how we helped to. That was one of the reasons we're able to get to within 1.5 seconds of the Ferrari by the end of the year with a 3-year-old chassis. Was we had Bridgestone tyres.
That's incredible because the fabled stories of the Bridgestone tyres. I think only six cars ran the Bridgestone tyres at that time. So that was Ferrari, yourselves, and I've forgotten completely now. Yeah,
me
yeah,
too.
Yeah, but basically, they had a little bit of an advantage. But the tale of lore is that they were, you know, designed around Michael Schumacher, and that Ferrari had this great relationship with Bridgestone.
100%. And when you, if you can design your chassis and develop your chassis and aerodynamics around the tires, you can make huge gains, which is why nowadays it's so much of a control system, because basically they had a great advantage.
Oh, this has been such a leap back in time. I have to say, because I was in my mid-20s at the time, I thought, oh, this is a little bit of my darkest period of remembering stuff from Formula One. But all of this is flooding back now. The tyre wars. When was the Indy Grand Prix, the Indianapolis Grand Prix?
Oh, I wasn't at that one.
That must have been 2005, perhaps.
Yeah, I think
right.
So. Yes,
so,
yes.
So just so for anyone listening, that is basically the Bridgestones were the only tyres that were allowed in the end to run. The rest of the teams withdrew. So there was only six cars on the starting grid. But you weren't involved in that. So we can't. I thought I could find a new person to blame for that. I guess the other interesting thing from your relationship with Honda was the drivers. So tell us a little bit about the driver selection. I know it ends up with Anthony Davidson, but it doesn't start as perhaps as glamorously as that.
Yeah, obviously Takuma. We had Takuma was one
Sato,
of the reasons
yeah.
why. Yeah, we basically were started because Takuma needed a drive, and we basically took him on, obviously. And we had Yuji Iida. We had Sakon Yamamoto. We had Frank Montani was there at one point. He was incredible as our third driver. That's when you had T cars, so the spare car that ran on a Friday. And obviously Anthony Davidson, who did an amazing job for us. And the two, having him and Takuma was really, really great fun.
So when you see Anthony Davidson with his analysis on the SkyPad, and he just has this deep understanding of driving. And I believe like things like being hired by the Strolls to teach Lance Stroll in a 2-year-old Williams before he came into Formula One. Like he's a massively impressive driver. And I remember at the time, like, oh, there's a new British driver in, but he didn't spend too much time at the sharp end of the grid. But I feel like you would have good things to say about him.
Oh yeah, we had a great time. It was a really fun time, as I say, over those couple of years at Super Aguri, and he was at, you know, in the central part of making us quick with him and Takuma together. We had a really, really great driver pairing.
So it might have been one of the more low-key driver pairings, really, because neither of those guys got to be at the very sharp end. But I like, you know, like Sato moving on with his American career, Anthony Davidson massively respected now. Like, how you must have been pretty pleased in the end to end up with a driver pairing like that.
Oh yeah, it was great, and they had a different style. So Takuma was a more of a sort of aggressive driver. Anthony was a much more a smoother driver. And what we noticed was that certain tracks, one of them will be better than the other because of the type of track and how it suited each driver's style. And so, you know, one circuit we say, well, you know, Anthony, you're going to be quicker here than Takuma. And this track, you're going to be quicker than Anthony because of the way you drive the car.
And you could see that in advance. And you could be like, sorry, Anthony, we know this is not a Davidson track.
So when you look at the surface of the track, now we're going to get really geeky about
No, please do. I won't understand, but our listeners will, so please do.
When you analyse the type of surface of the track, we could see that some tracks were more aggressive on the tyres, and we would say, all right, you're going to be able to warm up the tyres quicker at this track, Takuma, so you're going to be quicker straight away. Anthony, you're going to be a bit slower because this doesn't suit the tyre, the way you warm up tyres and the way you control the tyre wear and degradation. And so we did actually start to become able to say, this is going to be your track, this is going to be your track. And it did turn out to be the case. And we continue, and all the teams obviously look at this in the background. They look at the roughness of the surface in a few different parameters, and they can tell, you know, what sort of track this is going to be, how it's going to put energy into the tyres and those kind of things. There's a lot of science behind it, as you can imagine.
I wonder how much that still goes on today, because we talk about different driver styles a lot, but as you'd imagine, between 2008 and 2023, you'd imagine the driver market and driver skill in general would have evolved. But there must still be a nagging feeling, say, in Sainz's mind, and go, oh, we're going to Australia. That's not the kind of track that suits me. But we don't really hear about it, maybe because of the PR side of things.
I mean, we've still used the same techniques in Formula E. So we took a lot of the same ideas from that we'd learned in F1 and applied them in Formula E. We probably didn't have enough resources. We didn't have enough sensors on a Formula E car to be able to measure some of the things you can measure in F1. So we can't be sure in Formula E how some of those parameters work. But we continue to do some of the same types of analysis in Formula E as well. And that was certainly part of our success in Formula E, was understanding the tyres.
So how hard was it to get Anthony Davison in, though? Because when you first started, the driver you mentioned, ED, Yuji ED, was a 31-year-old Japanese rookie. So I'm going to go ahead and assume there was a big Honda influence in that initial driver lineup.
That was actually influenced by Aguri, actually, because he was racing for Aguri in Japan. So Aguri runs a Super GT team. And also at the time, he would have run a Formula Nippon, I think it was called at the time, a team there. So Yuji came from one of the teams in Formula Nippon.
And we should do some revision of Aguri Suzuki as a driver. What was his history?
Yeah, I mean, he's one of the most famous Japanese drivers because he was on the podium in Japan. So that was where he became, you know, super famous. He's still super famous, of course, in Japan. It's amazing when you go around. I mean, one of the stories when we went to the Japanese Grand Prix for the first time, when we approached the paddock, let's say, in a car, there was thousands and thousands of Japanese fans just waiting for Aguri and Takuma to come to the track. Unbelievable.
Amazing.
Unbelievable. The amount of fans in the grandstands that had Super Aguri flags was Ferrari and Super Aguri. That's what it was like at Suzuka. It was incredible, absolutely incredible.
And I think, say, maybe newer American fans and the European fans sometimes forget how popular Formula One is in Japan. And I was a massive Kobayashi fan as well, really disappointed when his career just fizzled out, because he did a crowdfund at one point and he got like £1 million ready to try and buy a seat. And then that didn't work out. And then I think he still kept the money and went racing elsewhere. Yeah. But we went a long time without a Japanese driver.
Oh, I mean, it's absolutely crazy. When Japan was once or twice the last race in the season, as people were packing down the cars in the last race, the Japanese fans would still be in the stands until we finished. And there used to be this competition, like a competition, I put it in inverted commas. And basically, people used to blow up the engines at the end of the season. So if you look at there's a video on the internet about a fire up at Japan. Basically, it's basically the car sitting on its stands and the guy's revving the engine
until it goes.
Exhaust blowing hot. And it didn't blow up, that one, but I know that historically there'd been some years where Jack Villeneuve just came out and just went full throttle, boom, the engine. So it was the end of the season, and certain teams would do that and certain teams wouldn't do it.
If you have that link, I will share it with our listeners in the show notes below. But to sort of focus in, because this conversation has gone longer than I promised, I do apologize, but hopefully we can get you back in the shed at some point. The Super Aguri story isn't one of, obviously it's only 3 years, but 2007 looked hopeful. There was points on the board. So to start with the positivity of that, and then obviously into the inevitable question of why didn't that then continue?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually looking back at it and seeing how many points we got. Of course, the points at that time only went down to
eighth, I think, at that point.
Eighth position.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a couple of times we ended up sixth and we got 1 point or something, or 2 points. But actually, if you'd had the current scoring system, we would have got, you know, quite a lot more points. But sadly, that was the time at which there was the financial crash. And
right.
If you remember, Honda, Toyota, Bridgestone, all of the Japanese companies pulled out of Formula One at that point. So it was pretty much at the point of the big financial crisis and Honda pulled out of F1.
Is that what led to Honda pulling out of Formula One? I actually didn't know that. Obviously, Braun then took that over in 2009 and won the Drivers' Championship that year.
Yes.
So I didn't realize there was a link between those two things. So did you feel the shockwaves of Honda support earlier than their eventual withdrawal.
Yes. Ah. Yeah, basically, that was it. Yeah, basically, that was in a nutshell.
But that's a shame, because in 2007, it was looking reasonably competitive, and those points weren't fluked points. They were expected points going forward. So did you go into 2008 going, oh, it's back to like the duct tape of the Arrows car this year?
I think everyone was quite hopeful, but there was a lot of things going on in the world that I think some of the ramifications of the financial crash were actually starting to ripple through before it became the big crash. So we were starting to feel some of those impacts before it was, let's say, common knowledge that the everything was going wrong in the world. We felt them a bit earlier.
So I had planned to ask you about Formula E, and I hope you will come back and talk to us, because I think if we look a decade ahead, or even like two decades ahead, we've got a convergence coming with the top tier of motorsport wanting to be road relevant. But I think for today, so that you don't get fed up with me and go, oh, he never let me get back to my dinner, right, I will leave it on one question mark. Are you happy that it was Super Aguri that you were involved in, or would you have preferred, if you can go back in time, would it have been Preston F1?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Preston F1 would have actually ever taken off with the same vigor, let's say, and had a car company like Honda behind it. So it was an incredible journey, and I really enjoyed working with Aguri and, of course, everybody at Super Aguri and Honda and everyone that made it happen. So I'm glad it went that way.
Mark Preston, thank you so much for your time. We're going to try and get everyone to swarm you on Twitter and pepper you with questions, and hopefully you'll come and join us in the shed again.
Thank you. Been good fun.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. I hope you enjoyed your midweek buffet. Join us on Sunday at 8 p.m. BST, that's UK time, UTC plus one, for our Australian Grand Prix race review. If you're a patron, you can catch our Friday live stream, pre-race, me and Matt get together and just chew through what we reckon we can tell from FP1 and FP2, and we divert and tangent and do all our doom scrolly lockdown remain indoors style content. It's essentially me and Matt catching up and inviting our patrons to come along for the ride. But wherever we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.